KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland in the Temescal neighborhood.
Jack London Square.
Adams Point.
Grand Lake neighborhood.
Coming up, will San Francisco's skyscrapers stand up against the big one when it hits? Seismic specialists hash it out.
They're intended to be within an inch of their life and barely avoid collapsing.
Then we explore one architect's process of designing sacred spaces.
When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
Then we visit a street in San Francisco known for people getting along.
This unique situation where peoples of different faiths will worship side by side is indeed a tribute to this great city.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Tall buildings versus the big one. Who do you think is going to win? San Francisco recently completed a first-of-its-kind study to figure that out. The study's called the Tall Building Safety Strategy, and it makes 16 key recommendations that could improve the city's readiness for a major earthquake. One group that's into that is SPUR. It's a San Francisco nonprofit that tries to demystify city planning. Recently, it hosted a talk about the new study. KALW's Michael Lockswingen went to see what he could learn.
In San Francisco's financial district, tall buildings tower over you like a super-sized Jenga set. Will they be safe during an earthquake? The short answer, yes. But there's a problem. How usable are they going to be afterwards? Apparently not very.
So the first thing to know is, by design, per the building code, buildings are intended to be broken and damaged.
That's David Marr. He's a structural engineer who focuses on seismic and sustainable design.
And under a major earthquake, they're intended to be within an inch of their life and barely avoid collapsing.
That's how the current building code sets it up. Instead of a building collapsing onto you during an earthquake, it basically collapses onto itself in strategic places.
It's analogous to a car crash. So when you have a car crash, automotive engineer does all these things to keep you alive, like your steering wheel collapses and the engine drops and you're in a safety cage, but your car is getting totaled. So your car is sacrificing itself for your life.
Same thing with a wrecked building. It gets all deformed and bent out of shape and it gets kind of stuck like that.
At the end of a maximum considered earthquake, you can have a building that's a teardown. It's optimized for safety, not for continued use or anything like that.
For the city, that's a problem.
We need people back in their homes within weeks, otherwise they're going to leave.
That's Aisha Hortaksu. She's a structural engineer who was part of the team that wrote up the tall building safety strategy.
Same with a major employer. That might be the occupant of a 40-story steel building in downtown. We need them to be able to reopen within weeks.
San Francisco already has 156 buildings classified as tall. By the way, a tall building is about the height of a full-grown sequoia tree, according to the study. If the big one strikes tomorrow, a lot of these 156 buildings will become unusable. The city doesn't require them to be structurally sustainable. They just have to meet the safety code. When it comes to designing buildings that won't collapse, it's all about redistributing the forces that travel through them during an earthquake. A common practice is to use shear walls and cross braces. Imagine two walls connected by a pair of diagonal beams that create an X. That X reinforces the strength of the two walls by sharing the load of an earthquake. It's great for safety, but not so great for building sustainability.
This is where the building first gets damaged, and it's the hardest part to repair.
That's David Marr again.
And when it gets damaged and the building deforms, then you have a hard time sort of, again, realigning elevators and things like that.
Here's how Marr would design them better. He wants to add what's called post-tension cables. Basically, they're like giant rubber bands built into the cross braces. They'd put a lot less stress on the joints between the braces and the walls.
And the whole idea is that during an earthquake, the walls will flex, stretch the rubber bands will realign the building. That's one of the initial big keys, that you have to get the building realigned. That's a structural strategy for making a resilient building.
What about buildings that already exist? Well, you have to retrofit them, and that's a hard sell for building owners because it isn't exactly cheap. But Mar thinks it's just about sharing the right information.
I think where we as a design community have really fallen short is that we're not telling anybody that their buildings, you know, are, some of them are just crap.
They'll keep you safe in most earthquakes, sure, but then they're trashed.
We don't tell our clients that they're going to get beat up, and we don't tell them what's going to happen. And so as long as there's no earthquake, everything's cool. And then afterwards, we're going to have an earthquake, and everybody's going to be so pissed off at us.
This all comes at a time when San Francisco's skyline continues to be redrawn. At the moment, there are 14 tall buildings recently completed or still under construction. San Francisco Mayor London Breed wants the next batch of tall buildings to be better. She's begun putting some of these new sustainability designs into the building code. And she wants to create a disaster recovery task force to help the city get back to normal as quickly as possible. But don't worry, when there is an earthquake, it seems pretty clear that these towering Jenga sets won't come tumbling down. In San Francisco, I'm Michael Locke, swinging for Cross Currents.
Michael reported that story as part of our summer journalism training program. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Architecture has the power to transform. A building can make us feel joy or sadness. We can feel powerful or weak because of a building. And nowhere is this more true than in a church, a chapel, synagogue, Buddhist temple, or a mosque. For centuries, religion has sparked the design of some of the world's most beautiful buildings. But what is that process? What built elements make a space sacred? KLW's Angela Johnston brings us the story of the design of a sacred space in Marin County.
Architect Susie Colliver says experiencing the design of a sacred space begins way before you even step foot in a building.
So we're in the parking lot of Kol Shofar.
That's a synagogue in Tiburon. We're surrounded by eucalyptus trees and grassy hills in the distance. The building is actually nowhere in sight. There's a twisting set of concrete stairs ahead of us. They wind around the trees, taking you 40 feet up the hill.
You leave the parking lot behind. You leave the everyday, you leave the secular behind. As you climb slowly, it's a very gentle rise of stairs.
We walk up the stairs. Colliver points out the concrete landings. They are imprinted with leaves from the trees above, and each landing has a bench.
It feels very doable. It feels very accessible. And psychologically, that's important, especially for people who are not as agile.
At the top, the synagogue finally comes into view. Its natural exterior blends into its surrounding. Colliver designed it 4 years ago. She's Jewish, but through her work designing low-income housing for religious groups, she's created sacred spaces for communities of all different faiths.
The hope is that from the parking lot up the curved stairs, that one is going through a process of quieting.
This is what you might hear walking through the entryway on a Saturday morning.
We're going to start with Ma Tovu, the prayer that's said upon entering a place of prayer.
That's the congregation's Rabbi Chai Levi.
It says, "How good are your tents, Jacob?"
Along with music, light seeps through gaps in the walls of this curved hallway.
Not unlike being in a forest, the light is coming through slatted wood. So the light is hitting every piece of wood along the curved path a little differently.
That's because before Colliver even begins putting pen to paper, she asks a committee of community members a central question: to recall a place where they felt most connected to a spirit beyond themselves.
It's very rare that somebody will say a cathedral. It's far more likely in our experience that they'll say a sunset on the beach, or they'll say a mountaintop with an endless view, or they'll say a grove of trees with dappled light coming through.
You can feel this as you emerge into an open, round space, the sanctuary. It feels like the center of a redwood grove. The curved rows of seating are colored with a burnt red fabric, matching the bark of the trees nearby. They wrap around the central bima or pulpit.
People frequently let out a sigh. I think people feel a small sense of awe, and it's pretty palpable. You see it on faces a lot. You can hear it in people's breath.
Sitting in a service, you'd see Levy in the center, and also the faces of about 100 others.
Adonai. When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other, and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
Levy says as soon as you put two people together, God is in the mix. It's something the rabbi and the committee wanted in Colliver's design.
I see both the beauty of people having prayerful experiences. And then also, you know, I see, honestly, the faces of people struggling with whatever they're going through in their lives.
Not only can people see one another clearly in the round, they can also see changes outside. Right above us is what Susie Colliver says is an important detail. There's a tradition in Judaism that the day starts not at midnight and not at daybreak, but actually when you can see the first three stars in the evening.
We gave them skylights through which you could discern when the new day had started by virtue of being able to see the stars. That was hugely important to them.
The design engages not just sight, but sound. Colliver says the congregation wanted to make sure everyone could hear each other.
We find that in many of the sacred spaces we're doing now, there is more emphasis put on participation than there is on sitting quietly and listening. The more important the room acoustics become, because it's less a single point of sound and more a communal experience.
That's true at Kol Shofar, where Rabbi Levy likes to lead interactive discussions. She also likes to lead the community in dancing, like at this recent children's service.
People holding hands and getting in a long line and dancing around. So, yeah, we were a community that wants to celebrate and feel joy together, and so having a space that people could dance in was definitely important.
So we're going to end with a prayer, with the words from the psalm that we sang earlier this morning.
When you look up to the ceiling from the bima, you'll notice a simple metal chandelier and a vaulted dome, which is offset from the center of the room. Colliver says this asymmetry is very intentional.
If it were symmetrical, there would be a suggestion that A, perfection is attainable, which we know it is not. We all have issues, we all have struggles, we all have conflict, and that conflict is made physical in this space. And people feel that very, very carefully.
Architect Susie Colliver says encouraging the search for meaning in the mundane is what spiritual architecture is all about. Whether it's the design of a synagogue, church, or a mosque. In Tiburon, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
That piece came from our project, The Spiritual Edge, stories at the intersection of belief and innovation. You can hear more at spiritualedge.org.
Adonai, Kaleh Adonai, Chazak v'ametz nigazah, v'gaveh Adonai, Kaveh, Kaveh, Kaveh.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Nearly 60 years ago, the city of San Francisco named a unique street Brotherhood Way. On the south side of Brotherhood Way, there's a row of churches and faith-based institutions. So how did this artery of road become the heart of different religious groups? KLW's Truk Nguyen has this story from our archives.
There's a road in South San Francisco that begins at Lake Merced where families stroll and ride bikes. Pigeons and seagulls sunbathe on the rocks, mallard ducks quack and paddle. As you head east on the street, the sound of birds are replaced by the whiz of cars. And you can start to see why this road is called Brotherhood Way. People zip past what is practically an entire neighborhood of religious institutions. There's a Masonic temple, a bilingual Armenian school, a Jewish day school, synagogue, Catholic, and Christian churches spread out on the mile-long road. Holy Trinity is the biggest building on Brotherhood Way. It's a Greek Orthodox church and can seat 900 people. Around 100 people sit listening to a Sunday morning service. Above them is a mosaic of the face of Christ that takes up the entirety of the church's 3,400 square foot dome and weighs as much as a fully loaded fire truck. I speak to churchgoer Mary Chicos after the service. She points to black and white photographs framed and mounted on the wall.
This is me, my mother-in-law, and the girls are here, but nobody recognizes them because they all look alike.
Yeah, I
the
think same. That's me. I'm not 100% sure, though.
Here.
Or maybe here.
And that's Maria Mistos, Mary Chicos' goddaughter. Maria's been coming to this church for 50 years, since she was 9.
We're all like a neighborhood. We know our fellow churches right next door, and we help one another.
Before it was home to all these religious institutions, and before it was even a road, Brotherhood Way was an arroyo, draining into Lake Merced. The land was largely undeveloped until a Catholic church called St. Thomas More bought a plot in 1951. At that time, the city sold parcels at a decreased rate to religious groups, groups like Congregation Beth Israel Judea. This is a Shabbat service at Beth Israel, where worshipers are welcomed with drums, tambourines, and singing. I speak to Rabbi Gottlieb after the service. He tells me that this synagogue sparked the idea to name the street Brotherhood Way.
Once it became a place of interfaith worship and gathering, the city fathers were persuaded to change the name to Brotherhood Way to reflect the ideals of our communities.
Gottlieb tells me there's a brotherhood association made up of religious leaders and members of various congregations.
Maybe quarterly, something like that, a few times a year to share what's going on in our communities. And there are a number of food festivals and other kinds of communal events that take place during the year on Brotherhood Way.
One of the bigger events that take place on Brotherhood Way is the annual Armenian Food Festival and Bazaar, hosted by the Calvary Armenian Congregational Church.
But inside the church, if you enter, as you see, we don't have too many statues and things like that. There's a simple Armenian cross in the pulpit.
That's Pastor Nurses Balabanian. His services feel a little more modern than, say, Holy Trinity, the Greek Orthodox Church. When he preaches, he points to PowerPoint slides with photos and words written in both English and Armenian. And in this particular sermon, Balabanian talks about selfies in a sermon about selfishness.
Selfies, it became a dictionary word, by the way. A photograph that one has taken...
Balabanian tells me that he prefers to really engage with his congregation instead of just speaking at them.
Sisterhood or brotherhood, I want to be inclusive, means... community means togetherness, people who come together. And we need that.
And not just in church, but across religions too. Rabbi Gottlieb agrees.
The name was changed to Brotherhood Way to acknowledge the peaceful coexistence of the various faith communities. And I think it stands as an example of how American society should be and could be.
When the city was first considering changing the street's name to Brotherhood Way, Sanford A. Marcus, a member of Congregation Beth Israel, wrote a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle.
This unique situation where peoples of different faiths will worship side by side is indeed a tribute to this great city where brotherhood of men has long been an established way of life.
Since then, Brotherhood Way has heard many languages and ways of worship.
At the same time, there is a time for collective prayer.
We are living in right side up in an upside down world.
Amen to that. For Cross Currents, I'm True Gwynn in San Francisco.
Tune in tomorrow at 5. We'll go on the hunt for the perfect plastic straw alternative.
Hear that sound? That's like air.
Yeah, well, you got a crack too.
Yep, I've not finished my drink and the straw is no longer sucking.
Are we just grasping at straws when there's bigger environmental issues to tackle? That's tomorrow at 5. Now it's time to listen to some local music. This is the Max Loria Trio from San Francisco. They're performing at Berkeley City Club tomorrow night. Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Sarah Lai Sterland. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Thank you.